observation in the reserve caused my mother being from that reserve. That's where I was brought up when I was 6 years old, and I went to Portage Indian Residential School there. I never knew my father until I was 17. And actually, I'm not what you call a treaty Indian, but I'm a Métis. I went to Portage for 7 years, 6, 7 years, something like that. And when my mother died, they sent me to Saskatchewan, West Dock, Saskatchewan, in another Indian residential school. It was run by the Oblate fathers and sisters. And it was a sort of an agricultural affair. Well, at those days, farming was a big thing, you know, in my younger days, and they thought they'd train us maybe to become farmers someday, you know. I stayed there for about 4 years, had a heck of a time with being a Métis, and talk about discrimination, they've got it. But however, I managed to survive that. First time I seen my father, when I was 17, the priest took me to Saskatchewan. And I didn't like my father because he never brought me up. But the day I seen him, I sort of fell in love with him. You know? And so, I worked around, I went to the States, stayed there for a while, and I came back, sort of roamed around. Them days used to be able to ride the rods, or what they call, boxcars, they used to call them the rods. And you'd go from town to town looking for jobs, odd jobs here and there, and spend the night in the jungles. I said right the other day, they still have jungles in the States, you know. They haven't got them here because the trains travel too fast now. But however, I used to go from town to town and work. Then I started, when I was there, just a year before the war, I started from Delta. I skated right to Dog Creek and I got a job. No, I stayed there for a couple of days and I got to Dog Creek. It took me 2 days on ice, you know, to skate. And my brother and I. Then from there we crossed over to Kennesaw and I got a job for a sheep rancher there, $5 a month. Mm-hmm.
What type of work were you doing there?
I was a sheep rancher, hauling hay and keeping stables and feeding sheep and all that. And then from there I went back to Sharpdale, Manitoba, where my oldest brother lived. I stayed there for a while and he said, why don't you go and get your dad? Our dad is getting old. And I bring him home and I look after him. My brother, oldest brother, told him. So he's fallen down. God. He come back, he stayed with us for a while and then the war, well, this was in 41. The war was already in session. He started 39 with him. 1940. And the war was already on, and then there was a talk about conscription. And I figured, well, rather than be conscripted, I think I should volunteer. So I asked my father for his advice, and he says, look, he said, I never brought you up. He says, you're 19. He says, it's up to you. So I up to Grandview, about 10 miles west of Sharpdale. Not west of Sharpdale, I mean east of Sharpdale. And then I was the only one that got in. From there, they sent me to Portage La Prairie. I had my basic training there for 2 months.
What type of training was that?
Basic training was just more or less parade square work, left and right turns, and learning about rifles, and...
Do you remember what type of rifle safe?
It was the old Ross, and then after that they introduced us to the Lee Enfield. And however, after 2 months' stay there, we were transferred to Winnipeg for our advanced training. I was just about a week in Winnipeg when, the brigadier, I believe it was, after they came back from Jamaica to use grenadier, volunteered to give us quite a spiel. Of course, I fell for that. And one of my older Indian friends told me, he says, "You better take your name off the list," he said, "you're walking the track." So it's too late, already signed up. So from there, we traveled to, CNR station. Around that area, I didn't know when to pay too well. Around that area, we boarded the planes. We thought it was great fun. And went to Vancouver. We got on an Australian ship. I think they called it Awati or something. It's some Australian name anyway. And from there, we went on Pearl Harbor.
Did anything happen in Vancouver after you boarded the boat?
Oh, there was a little, discussion. Anyway, some of the boys were going to walk off because they weren't satisfied with the accommodations on the ship. The older boys, of course, I was the youngest, and took everybody for granted. And however, they got us on the ship, and then we sailed for Pearl Harbor. We had to go way around, I guess, because of they suspected Japan was going to declare war. To avoid all mines and all this and that, we had to go way around. We got to Pearl Harbor, and from Pearl Harbor went around. I don't know how far from the Philippines, but we went around that way. And we eventually ended up in Hong Kong, where we got off ship in the Marchmont Stewart camp called Camp Chapeau. And we stayed there a couple of weeks. We just got nicely settled, and then they took us up to the hills. That was the island across from Kowloon. That's the, I guess this is where we docked off. It was Kowloon, then the marches to Samson Bowl. And we come back to Kowloon, and we crossed over by a ferry, and we went to Hong Kong, the island of Hong Kong, and it's supposed to be some, great Rock of Gibraltar or something, or some great structure, you know. And of course, it's all propaganda, and it couldn't be penetrated. So we understood English a little bit. But however, we were there for a couple of days just to get oriented. And then we went back to camp. No sooner got back to camp, well, they gave us leave and they said, "Well, go out for the night, come back the next morning." And so they all rushed us back in. The Japanese are just across the border and they're heading their way. And I was one of the fortunate ones to get away ahead, you know, at a time. Some of them were left, they were fired upon as they were leaving. So we got across, we all managed to get across to Hong Kong. And then I think the war lasted about 10 days and was shell fire and all of this and that. You're hungry and you had to live on corned beef from cans and hardtack, and you couldn't drink the water because it was condemned by our officers because there is a lot of tropical diseases in Hong Kong, and However, we managed to, we did have a few skirmishes.
Whereabouts in Hong Kong?
Wan Chai Gap. You probably heard about Wan Chai Gap. And on Mount Cameron, this is where we first got in contact with the Japanese. They were on Mount Cameron, and we were advancing up. I guess we made so much noise, you know, they thought, oh, there must have been thousands of us going up that mountain. They got scared and both retreated. In the morning, there was a few Royal Scots up there that were holding the fort. But however, we managed to go around Mount Cameron into Wan Chai Gap, and it was really raining that night. Pouring the rain, I'm just soaking wet. And the Japs were just across the road. I guess they were spent the night out too, but they were dug in or so. In the morning, just at daybreak, we sneaked up towards them, and we headed out to Afra. It seemed like a few, you know. It didn't last very long, but it seemed like all morning, you know, because when you're in a thing like that, you're scared. And, just like getting into a boxing ring with a guy, two men, I think it's 2 hours. But however, we managed to retreat. I remember I couldn't run fast enough. The planes were above, you know. All they could have done was just, they could have machine gun down on the road, you know, and they didn't have enough sense to get down right now. They were flying, they had to swim around anyway. Because we were surrounded by Japanese warships, we were surrounded with bearing, they had everything. They had the airplanes, they had everything. We lasted 10 days. They told us after that, and they were surprised. We figured it'd take down in 48 hours. It took them 10 days. All we had was rifles, a few breng guns, some machine gun, breng gun carriers, a few machine guns, a little bit of artillery. That was about all we had, you know. And of course we let them have everything we could get a hold of.
Which company were you in?
I was in A Company. Yeah. And Sergeant Major Fry. Major, I remember. I'm just going to jump onto the road, from the bush onto the road, and he yelled at me, "Look out." And I looked, and I just jumped on some mines. You know, I thought I jumped on and finished. So, however, I turned around, he told me to get behind him. As I got behind him, he got shot. Major finally told us, "Major, hope you didn't know me." He was our company commander. He died in a prison camp. His spinal meningitis. However, we all retreated back to the, I just can't recall what mountain this was, one of the highest mountains. I can't recall the name of it, but however, we stayed put. And the colonel told us just behave yourself because he says we're not sure whether the Japanese would take prisoners of war or not. At that time, I didn't think they recognized the international laws, you know. And however, they. Few boys crying around, you know, about their families and all that. Well, I was green, I didn't know any better. You know, it's young. And so they marched us from there to a ferry, if I remember rightly. And then they took us back to our old camp, Jamshapo. We stayed there. I had nothing to eat for about a month. You know, couldn't pass my stool for a month anyway, didn't have nothing to eat, you know. And we were starving. all the handles that make up a little bit of stew, like maybe half a cup of tea. We used cans for cups and whatever they could scrounge. And finally, the Japs finally brought in a little bit of rice and lived on rice. We stayed there for about a year. Then they put us to work anyway for a while and said they'd feed us better. I was failing already. I mean, I was getting sunblind from lack of vitamins, you know, proper nourishment. I couldn't stand the sun because it was too bright. And however, we tried to work there at the airport. Kaitak Airport, I think it was. And so finally they decided to, after being 2 years there, they decided to take a work party to Japan. And I was happy. They picked the fattest ones. And then when I got to Japan, I went to Nagasaki before it was bombed. I seen it before it was bombed. And about half a day's travel from there by train, but the trains go around mountains and all that. You know, it's a long road. Maybe it just went straight across it, you know, a short distance. And however, it took us to camp. Anyway, they fed us a little bit better. They gave me vitamins for my eyes and I sort of got my sight blind. And I worked in a coal mine there.
What was your job there?
I was drilling, and mostly drilling. And of course, the Japs were down there to sort of supervise and see that the ceiling was safe and all this, and, you know, sort of show us the ropes. And I worked as a driller there until I got hurt. I got a sort of cut, sort of a cave, and it was a type of rock. This one was 4x6. It was a great big rock. Anyway, it was a type of rock that this must have been about a foot thick. So type of rocks, and it's something that would break, crumble, you know. If it didn't, it would squash me there, I guess, you know, discarding the bank. And so, however, the next day, they tried to send me back to work, so the section leader, the Japanese section there, asked me how I felt in Japanese, and I told him I was sick. Sergeant, he says, this man should be there. So they put me in the hospital for a while until I got better.
What was the hospital like?
Oh, it was just the stretchers on the floor, you know.
Was it in the camp or outside?
It was in the camp, yeah. Just stretchers on the floor, and they had their medical supplies are very scarce, you know. And if anybody had diarrhea, all they had was powders, sort of give you a laxative, you know, and all that. And there was a lot of this they call this. I know I had a bit of it, that's how I started to break down. I got dysentery in this thing that you pass everything you got within inside, including the mucus, you know. It's a killing thing if you don't change. And all I had was Epsom salt, I mean, keep flushing out, and then you couldn't eat, because if you ate, it was the more you had to go to the toilet, you know, and your insides were, you were rupturing your inside. A lot of water died with it. But however, I managed to live through that, and we had rumors that how the war was progressing and all that. Of course, you know, maybe guys is wishful thinking, I don't know. But one day we seen this great big ball of fire, you know, and we wondered what it was. And I guess that's when they bombed Nagasaki. stayed in camp for just about 3 weeks to a month. And they threw the gates wide open. One morning we woke up and the Japs surrendered. There was nobody around, no guys, no nothing. So the major in charge, he says, okay, you're free to go in and out wherever you please. But come back and we'll give a few blasts in the siren and time you to come back. We stayed there about a month about 2 weeks, I guess, before they actually spotted us. We had mirrors, very big mirrors. And every time we seen a plane, we knew it was an American plane, trying to signal. One day they spotted us, and then they came down. Twice they came down, and finally they let this parachute all these groceries down and all the food and supplies.
Was there any change in the in your work or in the guards during the last few weeks before the Japanese surrendered?
Well, there was a bit of tension, they sort of took it out of our eyes. They knew they were losing, and every time they lose a battle, maybe we feel it,
Was there any change, in the amount of coal you had to process?
No.
Were you given a quota every day?
Every day we had a certain amount. I mean, if you finished it in a short period of time, you could lay down and sleep, Of course, we used to work, finish our quota. And especially the supervisor we had, he was pretty fair with us. And, however, when these parachutes came on, all different colors, it's pitiful to see these guys hobbling around, it's all happy. And, as I said, I was happened to be one of the healthiest ones, I guess. So they put me in charge of collecting all the parachutes, trying to do a lot of running. Nobody confiscated, especially the Japanese. But we managed to gather them around, and they were afraid of us, at the start. The old ladies, it was so pitiful. The old ladies, as soon as you walk into town, they'd kneel down and kiss the ground. I guess this is the way they were trained. They had some kind of a philosophy or something that we were, barbarians or something, But we treated them well. Before we left there, we had lots of friends. They realized we weren't as bad as they were. From there, the Americans come and pick us up. Went by train to Nagasaki. This is when we seen it after the bomb. Just a valley. Ships turned over in the dock. The odd building in Aspen, Americans whipped us right through there. As soon as we got to the docks, they rigged up showers and clothing and stuff. As soon as you took off your old clothes, you walked through the showers and gave you sprays, DDT and all that. By the time you got on the ship, you were fully dressed. It was amazing how fast those Americans were working. Then they took us to the Philippines.
Did you go on the boat?
Yeah.
Do you recall what boat it was?
No, I don't. It was a small battleship anyway. So they took us to the Philippines, and then they kept us there about a month. But we had to be very careful when we ate because we were sick. Our stomach was just upset. We stayed there for approximately a month. And then they got a great big aircraft carrier, I don't recall the name of that either. And what was it there? Steel. Around Hawaii, there in the whole pressing on that steel, they're just burning hot. They had beer there, and things were just like, wow. warm water. You couldn't find a cool spot anywhere. Finally, we got to Hawaii. They let us off there for a night.
First, we celebrated.
And then, from there, we started coming back to Canada, and you could feel that. Every day it was getting cooler and cooler and cooler, and finally we ended up in Eskimo, BC.
Did you go to San Francisco at all?
No, I didn't. And we ended up in Eskimo, and apparently anything you want to eat, but I couldn't eat it. I just took my pills and it worked away. And then my sister-in-law was there, and my nephew, my brother-in-law, and he was coming over. And just before I got on the train, he said, come on outside. So I went out to the station. He said, would they miss you again? I don't think so. So they took me home, and they tried to feed me, and I couldn't eat. I just couldn't eat, I don't know what it was, upsetting, nerves, or tension, or what. But however, I was pretty sick for quite a while. I had to call palpitations, and I hadn't had it for years. It still bothered me, in fact. However, I managed to get back to Winnipeg.
Do you recall what date it was? Or what month?
Winnipeg. I don't recall. No. I remember my brother coming from Chardin, Manitoba, coming to meet me. And his first gift was a big bottle of whiskey, about 26. Couldn't drink it. No, it just completely upset you. My stomach ached. And then, finally, I was away about a month, and then I'll come back to Winnipeg and report it to the depot for the other barracks. And I took sick. I got jello jaundice. And then they kept me in the hospital there for about a month. They wouldn't let me out of bed. Finally, I asked the doctor if he'd let me out of bed. And he said, yeah, he said, better than well. He said, yes. I've been in prison long enough. So from there, I finally got discharged. But what actually happened to my mind was, I think if I'd have been there any longer, I would have went. But I probably went nuts, because of the mental anguish, torture. You want to go home. You're hungry, continuously hungry. It wasn't just a normal existence, and it took me years to sort of think straight again. It took me a long time to actually come back to normal, and I think this is one of the worst things that could happen to a person, especially a person this young. There were guys younger than I was, but when you're young like that, a good part of your life is taken away from 19 to 23. And it took me a long time to come to my proper senses. I'm still not in the right mind. No, but I think that this thing should have been considered by the Canadian government, because when you go through mental torture, anguish like that, it's actually hell on earth. I don't know. I never like to talk about it, but still, you dream about it sometimes. You're fighting. I went back there. Not back to Hong Kong, but I went back to Korea during the Great Dampening. And it was just like night and day. Just like paradise after that. But when they found out I was in prison of war, they probably just picked me up every night, locked me up, let me out in the morning for 2 weeks. Supposed to be on leave. Well, that's about all I can recall.
And what type of work did you go back to after the life in Hong Kong? You came back here and you got your discharge.
Yeah.
Where did you go after that?
What did I do? Oh, I tried all kinds of construction work. Worked with Pauline Chamber for a while, worked with Burns, worked on a farm. I ended up in Fort Osborne Barracks in a storm for about 4 years. I worked for the airport. And then this last while I worked for the parks, where I was sent home because of my back condition, my arthritis, my spine. At the present time, we can't work anymore. That's the story of my life.
When you're in the prison camp, did you know? When you're in the prison camp, did you notice if the Japanese treated their own men quite harshly, or did they beat them up at all?
This is one thing you can't do in a Canadian army, is it? An NCO, that's a non-commissioned officer, hit a private, or slapped a private, but they could use force, extreme force.
Did they do this quite often?
Or did they? Yeah, they had, I guess they've changed a lot since, but the way they were trained, they were going to rule the world and all this and that, they mistreated their own soldiers too, because they didn't give them much to eat because they didn't have much themselves, you know. That's the reason why I guess we got the short end of the stick, because we, you know. As far as I didn't read up on that, I got slapped around a couple of times, but I haven't experienced what a lot of boys talk about. I haven't experienced that, you know, where they get kicked around and all that.
Did you have a camp interpreter?
Yes.
What was he like?
We had one in Kowloon. We call him Kamloops. And they had quite a trial here when he came back. He was educated in Kamloops. He was a university student.
What was he like in the camp?
Oh, he was very mean and treacherous. So I think he got hung on him.
And what about in Japan? Was there an interpreter there?
Oh, they had three or four different interpreters.
Were they Japanese people, or?
Yeah, Japanese.
And did they help you quite a bit? Could they speak good English and good Japanese?
Yes, they could. Well, they spoke to the higher officials, you know, and us, we were just ordinary Joes, you know. We had to take up and shut came, and that was it. Yeah, but this Kamloops, he was a very well educated man. They did try, some of the officers tried classes, you know, different English classes, German classes, and various other things to try and get the boys interested. And, we had concerts once in a while, you know,
What type of entertainment was it? Was there singing or
mostly, you know, when you get a bunch of troops together, they all make a sing song together, you know. And they've tried that. They try to make things the best way, you know, more as interesting as possible, though. But with nothing, I mean, there isn't much you can do with there. So, that's about it.
Did any of the men manage to sneak any musical instruments into the camps?
There was the odd musical instrument, yeah.
Was this in Japan, too, or just in the...
This was in, yes, in Hong Kong there was a few musical instruments, and in Japan they did supply, whether they supplied or not, I don't remember quite more, but I know there was a couple of instruments. And finally, they used to get me and another chap from England. He was an amateur accordion player, you know, and I used to play with him, you know, together. And they used to take us to the, and they had parties, these Japanese dudes. And anything is left over to eat, you know, would eat. But, and they got feeling good, they used to give us sake, you know, and they got feeling good, they started their sword dances, and waving these swords around, you know. He scared the daylight of them. Yeah, we did get into a few of those dances. But all right.